Hello and welcome back to yet another episode of the VC Bruna podcast, a podcast that provides a unique perspective of the startup world through the lens of venture capitalists and entrepreneurs. I'm your host Digjay, and today I have with me Pankaj Makar, Managing Director at Bertelsmann India Investments, which is a strategic investment arm of the global Bertelsmann Group. The Bertelsmann Group has invested more than $1 billion in over 250 companies and funds across the globe. Established in 2012, Bertelsmann India Investments is a sector-agnostic early-to-growth stage fund that has invested in category-defining companies like Eruditus, Licious, Shiprocket, Pepperfry, AgroStar, Wymo, among others. The firm also recently closed its new $500 million India fund. In this episode, Pankaj talks about his path leading up to Bertelsmann, evolution of Bertelsmann's India investment strategy, why now is a good time to accelerate investments in India, challenges faced in evaluating growth stage startups, Pankaj's perspective on the exit landscape in India, mental models to identify stellar startups, and more. This was an amazing conversation with Pankaj, where he shares some very insightful perspectives and mental models about growth stage investing. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So, without much ado, let's jump in and find out what Pankaj has to share. Hey Pankaj, welcome to the VC Bruna podcast. Thank you so much for taking out the time.
Thank you very much, Digjay. It's a pleasure to be here and super excited to be part of the podcast and look forward to a very interesting conversation for the next 45 to 60 minutes.
Awesome. Likewise. And Pankaj, you know, maybe for our audience who doesn't know you yet, we can start off with a brief background about yourself. You know, tell us about your path leading up to Bertelsmann.
Sure, no, happy to do that. So very quickly, my name is Pankaj Makar. I run Bertelsmann India Investments. Before Bertelsmann and BII, I have been an investor in India and Asia since early 2000s. In that time frame, from 2001 to 2011, I was working with a group called Usaha Tegas. Think of them as the Tatas of Malaysia. And they were making investments in Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, in India, etc. And I worked with them, making a lot of private equity type investments, anywhere in the range of about $30 million to $300 million check sizes across sectors like media, real estate, hospitality, power, oil and gas, telecom, and satellites. And while I had an awesome time doing that, when I joined Bertelsmann in 2009, I got the opportunity to look at what we could do for our Asia and India business, given that that's where I'd spent a lot of my time before Bertelsmann. And in 2011, I came to India and I set up the India business for Bertelsmann. That, of course, included looking at our strategic businesses that Bertelsmann has in India, whether it's Penguin Random House today, Fremantle, and so on. But also at the same time, we had ambitions to start our venture activities in India, which we did in 2011 under the brand called Bertelsmann India Investments.
So you've been used to investing in a diverse set of sectors, you know, from your early days, and which is a tough thing to do, you know, as an investor today. You know, Pankaj, if you could give us a background about the fund as well. You know, you said you started the corporate venture arm in 2012. How has the investment strategy evolved, you know, from the time you started? It's been almost 10 years. And if you could also talk us, how does the strategy change with the launch of the latest $500 million fund as well?
Sure. When we started BII in India, what we realized was that there were a lot of Silicon Valley funds, really, really good funds like Accel, Sequoia, Lightspeed, et cetera, that had already made reasonable inroads into the market. They were, most of these funds were established around the 2006-2009 vintage. And by 2012, they had taken a market share in the VC market, which was again kind of developing from a nascent stage to a slightly more mature stage. What we realized was that while all of these funds were early stage funds, which fundamentally means writing seed checks or Series A checks, there was nobody in the market who was writing Series B, Series C, Series D checks, which was basically what we call as mid-stage investing. And given that there was a lack of funds focused on this area, we thought as Bertelsmann, And we all think of ourselves as large business builders, because as Bertelsmann, we pride ourselves in building large global businesses, which are very relevant in different parts of the world, including in India, in Asia, US, Europe, et cetera, et cetera. We have built some amazing brands. Now talk about Penguin Random House, talk about BMG, talk about Fremantle Media that does Pop Idols, X Factors, India Got Talent, and all the Got Talent series. These are all global brands and businesses that we've built. And that is something we thought we brought to the table in a very significant fashion, wherein we could evaluate new startups from a business perspective, which could happen not at an early stage, but in the mid stage, and build a fantastic practice. The second thing that we did, Digjay, is that we decided that we're going to play an anchor asset strategy. And what that means is we would not invest in 30, 40, 50 companies in a fund. That's typically what you see when you look at a fund. They would have a lot of portfolio companies, and out of which only a handful of them would do very well and give most of the returns, which is what we call as power ratio. What we thought was we will create a reasonably diverse but yet concentrated portfolio of about 10 to 15 assets. And we want to make sure that out of those 10 to 15 assets, almost 7 to 10 of them work. And by virtue of that, and you know how complicated Indian market is and startup ecosystem is, just having that kind of ambition was honestly a very difficult one. But yet we went out as entrepreneurs building such a practice. And I can say that 10 years down the line, we are very happy that we now have very successful category defining or sector defining companies, whether it's Eruditus in the education space, it's Licious, which is in the meat space, ShipRocket in the e-commerce aggregator space, or Pepperfry in the furniture space. Each and every company that we ended up backing ended up being sector leader. And that itself was very exciting. And that gives us a lot of proof point that the strategy that we put together of playing mid-stage investing as well as the anchor strategy worked out very well for us. Now, your second question was, what's changed and with the new fund? As you correctly mentioned, we have just raised $500 million of corpus with Bertelsmann, and we will be deploying that in India and the region nearby, or even Indian companies which are going global. I think the mid-stage investing strategy, which is core to our business, stays as it is. We continue to make investments, and we actually, interestingly, lead all our investments. We never follow in a investment. We are a lead fund. So we always lead investments in mid-stage. But alongside that, we feel that the Indian ecosystem has now matured to an extent, and our capabilities have become a lot more stronger, where we are in a cautious way getting into early stage investing and doing Series A bets as well.
Got it. No, Pankaj, that's definitely very helpful background. And to understand, you know, the unusual approach at the time. And it's still pretty rare to have that concentrated strategy of, you know, just having that conviction, especially at the mid stages. And you're right, you know, India is now evolving. And of course, you're bullish on India, you know, and it shows with the $500 million fund. If we can, you know, dive deeper into that and talk about the India bull case, you know, why do you think now is a great time, you know, to accelerate your investments in India and take a, you know, bullish bet on India at this point in time?
Sure. I would say that there are probably three large macro tailwinds which are leading us to take such a decision. Mm-hmm. The first one, of course, is the entire macroeconomic climate. As far as India is concerned, vis-a-vis the global ecosystem. When we look at the GDP growing in India, the real GDP growing in India at about 6 to 8%, and you have different reports giving different answers, that is a pretty impressive growth rate for a large economy. And we don't see any other large country having such high growth rates for the next 5 to 7 years. So that is pretty impressive. And what that means is that we have massive amount of population in India. It is a young population. The economy is growing, and that's going to add significant amount of disposable income in the hands of Indians. And they would want to consume a lot of products and services by spending that extra income that they are earning, which means the demand for services and goods would increase multifold. That's a great ecosystem to be part of. That's point one. Point two, while there is significant amount of demand which is coming in from these new consumers who will now have more disposable incomes, on the supply side in India, we have low level of brand penetration and service and product penetration. What that fundamentally means is, and I'll give you an example of, let's call it retail. If in the US, Walmart from the 1960s till the 1990s took that much amount of time to organize the retail sector and a lot of other companies, but I'm giving one specific example, from the unorganized structure of the market that existed in 1950s and before, it was Amazon that took this organized market online. In India, we have host of sectors which are unorganized and they need to be taken and made organized, as well as they need to be digitalized at the same time. And which is why we saw that companies like Amazon and Flipkart end up doing both organization and digitalization.
Correct.
Now that concept and building massive supply will not only happen by offline companies, a lot of that will happen by online companies. To give you an example, our portfolio company Pepperfry, which is the largest furniture company in the country, is not only digitalizing an existing offline base. Offline base fundamentally continues to be unorganized. 95% of furniture e-commerce or furniture market in India is unorganized. That is a massive tailwind on the supply side. And again, that theme continues to play on and on in our thesis. We look at Licious, which is a meat company, meat highly unorganized sector. It's getting organized, it's getting digitalized, and Licious and a few other companies are doing it and so on. That theme per se works very well for us. Lastly, third point, when we look at India as a market, nothing happens very fast, but massive amount of value is built over a longer period of time. From that perspective, if entrepreneurs or venture capitalists or investors in general have a point of view that I'll come into India and make money in 5 or 7 years, I don't think they will have a good outcome. You need long-term capital to build massive amount of value, and patient capital do that. Interestingly, Bertelsmann, with 185 years plus of existence, we are as long-term as it can be. And we take a view of at least 10 years and 20 years and 30 years and not just a short-term view. And we think that because of that, our approach to India is very synergistic to what India offers to investors like us.
Agreed. I think that's, again, a very important and comprehensive, you know, perspective on India and why it is the right time to be invested. And like you rightly said, you know, having that long-term perspective is important because the current set of entrepreneurs are solving those hard problems, like you mentioned, trying to solve for the supply chain, trying to organize the market. And I think that's going to lay out a very foundational platform for the companies that will, you know, innovate on top of that. And, you know, being early in that sector and having gone through those learnings through this cohort will, you know, give the investors a lot more advantage with the next batch of investments. And if I'm right, Pankaj, BII has an evergreen fund, right?
Yeah, that is true. I'm glad that, our partners, people like Sequoia, et cetera, are not thinking of building evergreen funds. The good news is we have always been an evergreen fund since our inception. So I'm glad that we probably caught on to that wave much before the rest of the market got it. And I do feel that that gives us significant amount of advantage as a fund to help founders build companies over a longer period of time. And that's very critical in how we build businesses in a country like India, where it does take longer to build large amount of value.
Absolutely. And I'd like to, you know, dive in a bit deeper on that. But before that, you know, Pankaj, want to talk about, you know, the investment decision-making thought process at Bertelsmann. And I'm sure, you know, you've had your own share of learnings over the last 10, 15 years. Investing in mid-growth stage startups, you know, is kind of tricky because you're looking at mature startups and potentially there are two or three mature startups that are, you know, vying for that new market or a new category that they're creating. So it becomes difficult to, you know, make that bet. Just want to understand from your thought process, right? What does it ultimately come down to, right? If most of the things are kind of similar in the two or three startups that you're evaluating, especially for mature startups.
So I think that's a very interesting point. And I would say that's where our entire strategy is kind of built. You correctly mentioned that mid-stage investing, even in the valley, is called the valley of death. because most of the companies and funds which operate in that space like us do not have the success that we have had till date. I hope that we continue with the success and do equally good or better, but we still recognize that it is an extremely tricky space. We are paying high valuation for companies which still carry significant amount of risk, which means that if we lose, we will lose big, and hence we need to be very careful. Now, as we think about building our portfolio under this structure, we think of risk in a significant fashion. And what we have done internally is that we have divided risk that a startup has into binary risk and non-binary risk. Binary risk is a risk that gets the company to fall and die. A non-binary risk is if that scenario plays out, we may end up with a lower outcome and not a failure. To give you an example, if the company does not have product market fit, it will fail unless they pivot and create a new product and get new product market fit. That's a separate issue. However, if it's not a winner take all market and two players are there today, and we think the two players will get 50-50% market share of the serviceable market that we attribute to the sector. If three more come in, then total players will be five, and instead of 50%, each will have 20% market share. It is not a binary risk. It is a non-binary risk, which can lead to lower valuation and business performance and hence lower valuation, but we don't lose our money. As Bertelsmann, it is our intent to have as little of binary risk as possible. We can't eliminate it completely, but if we can keep our eye on binary risk and play the game accordingly, where our diligence tells us that we are avoiding that kind of risk, we will end up with good outcomes, even if they are not the greatest outcomes ever. And a combination of that will still give us good to great outcomes and hopefully not bad outcomes.
Got it. And Pankaj, are there any, you know, from experience, any particular sectors that you'd like to mention where it was difficult to assess this risk?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we talk about it locally over here. Talk about fintech and lending especially. And we have a couple of portfolio companies in that. When companies come to us, they come and tell us, we have given loans to 500 people, 1,000 people, 20,000 people, 1 lakh people. Just by giving extra loans to people and hence showcasing that how big we have come is no guarantee that those guys will give you the money back. So from that perspective, the risk does not go away. It's not equal to 500 people versus 100,000 people buying your product and you saying, listen, people are buying my product, which means I've built something useful. In a lending business, you are giving people money. Trust me, everybody will take the money. You and I will take their money. The question is whether we'll return it back. And hence you have to wait for the full cycle for that money to come back to assess whether this is working or not. So hence there are sectors where these risks can be assessed easily, and there are sectors where these things cannot be assessed. And we keep that in mind when we're evaluating such businesses.
Yeah, and I think which is where, you know, the skill set of the investor also comes about as to, you know, what are the right questions to ask, or what's the right amount of time for you to wait, you know, to make that decision or to make that bet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. If I were to add, listen, you know, when we were looking at making bets in the mobility sector in India, and mobility is Uber, Ola, again, large companies have come out of that in India. But when we were evaluating a lot of these companies in Series B, a lot of them were getting users by giving significant discounts.
Correct.
We were not sure at that time whether it's the value proposition that will work or is the discounting that is leading to that outcome. And from that perspective, it was very difficult to judge which will be the winner. And if we can't figure out what will be the, which company will be the winner, we skipped the entire category altogether. Now, if I were to ask that to other funds, they will say, what's wrong with you guys? You are leaving. You had the opportunity to invest in Ola in India and you did not do it. Honestly, at that time, I did not know Ola will become Ola. And let me recognize that in all humbleness, that as Series B player, it's very difficult sometimes to even judge that. And we are very conservative from that perspective, that we are happily saying that we will escape that. And yes, once we know that this is working out, probably at a slightly later stage in Series C, Series D, we might still pick up some stake. But there are situations where we don't want to do that early on.
Agreed. And it totally makes sense, you know, especially with a concentrated portfolio strategy, because some of these early stage investors, they have a very diversified portfolio. And like we talked about, you know, the power law plays out and they happen to be a part of those winners. We don't talk a lot about deals that went to zero or, you know, the outcomes and did play out as they expected. So I think it totally makes sense with, you know, with the strategy and approach that, you know, Bertelsmann has. Pankaj, just an adjacent point here. We talk about some sectors, you know, which are kind of difficult to assess. There are also times when, you know, sectors become hot, like we've seen previously in EdTech, recently in, you know, Web3. And I think it kind of creates a lot of noise for the investors too. There's a lot of FOMO because, you know, you're trying to get into the deal, the valuations are going up. As an investor, you know, how do you approach, just from your experience and maybe, you know, what do you think in general could be ways where investors can mitigate the noise in such situations?
That's a very interesting point. You know, first of all, I can say that most of the investors love the noise because that they are the ones who make the noise. So all of us are guilty of that. Having said that, look, if there's a lot of noise, I think one thing that we need to understand and evaluate is that we need to figure out why that noise is coming. Is the noise coming because COVID has happened and digitalization has had a massive positive fillip, and because of that, certain sectors have become hot and will continue to be hot? And it's a structural shift in the ecosystem where certain sectors have emerged much better than others. And if that is the case, that noise is a good noise. We all need to jump in and, you know, take that opportunity and make investments. Health tech, ed tech in the last few years have been like that. Having said that, a lot of time the noise exceeds the level of what the opportunity is. But if you are a long-term investor like we are, and you're playing it for the next 5 to 7 to 10 years, honestly, at some point noise will die. But if the structural shift have happened and this is a good business, it will make money for you. So hence, I don't worry about the 2 to 4 year noise that comes with such issues. If there is structural reasons to make investments, all of us should make investments. Having said that, if there are no structural reasons why something has become hot, then please avoid it in all fashion. But listen, all of these are opinions, and a lot of times my opinions on why something is hot versus not could be very wrong. We are all humans and we make human mistakes. And from that perspective, I would say different investors come in with different theses, and they do think that the noise that they see is not noise, but structural shifts in the structure, in the economy, in various sectors. And that's what they're trying to back, which makes sense.
Yep. And, you know, while being in that environment, Pankaj, from your experience as well as fellow investors, what do you think have been, you know, common pitfalls or missteps that, you know, investors take, especially when this kind of noise or, you know, mania is created around a specific sector?
I think some of the missteps we end up kind of taking as investors is that we forget and stop assessing the capability of the founders and the founding teams to build a sustainable business. We listen to the noise, we look at the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and we think that that's pretty impressive. And we end up missing out the fact that it'll take significant of effort to reach that pot of gold. And that effort also means having significant capability in the management team to reach there. The second problem that I think, and this is mostly investor-led and founders actually get trapped in that, is that all venture capitalists, people like us, are trying to play for large gains. By large gains, we want our portfolio companies to be unicorns, and if not unicorns, now these days decacorns, and then so on, which by virtue of that puts massive pressure on founders to deliver a business which they may not have ever wanted to build, or that business is not worthy of building. And that creates massive problems later on when you execute such a strategy and raise a lot of money and burn a lot of money, wherein you realize that that big pot of gold was never there. So I think some of these missteps harm investors and entrepreneurs in a longer period of time, and hence being cautious about some of these things and taking measured approaches probably is a better strategy to kind of play.
Agreed. And it also speaks to the point that, you know, founders also need to be cognizant about what kind of investors they're bringing on board, having that alignment, you know, from the day they bring that capital in, because having long-term alignment, you know, just helps out in terms of maintaining expectations and being able to achieve those growth metrics, you know, without the pressure that the investors can consciously or subconsciously put on. Pankaj, you know, another interesting aspect of being a mid-stage or a growth stage investor is you kind of see, you know, who has been the early stage investors or who has backed them before you come in to the cap table, right? And it's difficult to like not unsee that and not process that signal. as a mid-stage investor? How do you think about that dynamic? You know, how do you try to not have bias about who is investing, you know, before Bertelsmann?
So actually, I like that bias, honestly. First of all, I respect all the venture capital funds that are there in the ecosystem. They are full of amazing professionals, whether it's at partner level, associate level, analyst level. And those are all very, very smart people. If a bunch of those have made a choice that a certain company and a certain sector is doing good, we would give them a benefit of doubt to say, listen, probably they are seeing something that we should also see. And we will go in with a positive view. And hence that having that bias is a good idea. That's the whole reason why we're coming at Series B. We need a lot more proof point to show something is working. That proof point can come in by having better numbers. It can come in by virtue of seeing the competitive dynamic in the market, and can also come in by seeing the kind of investors that are backing certain themes, and does it kind of make sense. From that perspective, it is a very positive signal, and we take it like that. Having said that, that is not the only signal that we are looking at while making investments, and a lot of other things need to play out, which as and when they do, means that we should make that bet and we make that investment.
No, I think that's definitely helpful. You know, looking at it as one part of the puzzle, not, you know, the only part that you over-index your decision-making on. Pankaj, you know, with that, I want to talk some more about the fund management aspect, you know, your responsibilities and strategies as a fund manager. And it's interesting because, you know, depending on the size of the fund, the strategy, you know, whether you want to take concentrated or diversified bets, you construct and design your portfolio in different ways. Just want to understand, you know, from Bertelsmann's approach, how do you think about portfolio construction? What are the check sizes that you like to, you know, put on in the first stage? And then how much do you plan to reserve for follow-ons?
Sure. So what is very interesting about Bertelsmann is that Bertelsmann's venture capital activities are spread around the globe. We have a common IC of extremely smart investors, people who have made investments across the globe in more than 300 companies. And it's a very active investment committee chaired by the CEO of Bertelsmann Investments today, Carsten Korsfield. And people who have been part of the investment committee are just amazing people who look at deals across the sectors, but also they have helped run funds, whether it's in China, US, Brazil, India, Southeast Asia, and Africa, across different stages. So they understand the nuances of running venture capital businesses. Now, when I look at BII and how using all of that collective intelligence, we are able to put together a very interesting portfolio construction strategy, which we think is probably benchmarked with what we see around the world, and hopefully by virtue of that has less mistakes and more wins there. What that means for us is, as a mid-stage fund, we aspire to have less than 30% of our capital in what we call as businesses which do not have a good success rate. Anything less than 1x principal return is not a good case for us. And we hope that 70% plus of our capital ends up in businesses which have a high hit rate business as well as successful business and so on. If we have to achieve that, we have to make sure that our failures are few and managed. In the new fund that we have, which is $500 million, our first check size is anywhere in that $10 to $15 million zone in our core business, which is Series B, Series C, Series D. Mm-hmm. And we typically, unlike other funds which like to reserve 1:1 for follow-ons, our reserve policy is a lot more liberal, and we typically go 2:1 or even more in our good companies. What that does is, if the companies are doing very well, we have the opportunity to double down and triple down very fast in those companies and build reasonable positions. If these companies continue to behave as anchor assets, like we discussed in the beginning of the podcast, we also feel that they will generate massive amount of value and give us significant amount of returns back to us. So over a lifetime of a company, we can easily put anywhere between $20 to $40 million, which is significant amount of money from one fund, mid-stage fund, going into these companies. For our early stage programs, of course, we will start with smaller checks, but we hope that they go to Series B and they go into our big core bread and butter business, and we end up deploying the same type of capital in those companies also, as and when they are successful.
Got it. And I think it also speaks to the flexibility that, you know, that Bertelsmann has and the way it can help founders, you know, when they bring on Bertelsmann on board, having that flexibility and being able to back you, not just in one round, but through multiple rounds as you keep growing is definitely, you know, something that founders should consider and are considering today. And Pankaj, we spoke about, you know, being an evergreen fund, having that long-term view of taking, you know, 7 years, 10 years out. But also at the same time, it's important to like look at exits opportunistically, you know, to be able to return the original capital that you're investing. How do you see the current exit landscape in India? You know, we've seen some exits come through IPO, but maybe the results haven't been, you know, as rosy as we thought it would be. Just your perspectives on, you know, where India is at and how do you think about exits?
I think, look, exits almost 5-6 years back were non-existent. At least in the last 5-6 years, we started to get some first level of exits. They could be by virtue of trade sale. They could be by virtue of doing secondary deals. They could be virtue of by selling stakes to select strategics and some handful of companies going for an IPO. I do feel that as and when and India and Indian startups end up building good, defensible and sustainable businesses, there should be takers for those businesses, both at a secondary or trade sale basis, or it could be for IPO or strategic basis. Those are the three ways in which companies mostly end up being sold and investors end up selling their stakes. And I do feel that that ecosystem will only become better as we kind of build these good companies. What I understand is globally, there is significant amount of capital that is available, as well as there's significant amount of strategic interest in a country like India, which is fast growing, has a lot of population and hence a lot of scope for growth for strategic companies, as well as financial providers who want to play the country properly. And by virtue of that, I think more exits will come. What we have to make sure is the quality of companies that we take to these buyers is definitely good. And for those good companies, we will get the buyers. My view is that whether it's late stage investors, financial investors, whether it's IPO markets in India, or there are strategic investors, all of them typically like profitable companies which are sustainable. From that perspective, we would like businesses to be profitable at the EBITDA level. They should, given that they are technology companies, they should be growing at anywhere between 25 to 35-40%, if not more. And they should have built a business which is defendable and hopefully a market leader or among the top market makers of that sector. If these characteristics are there across sectors, I'm sure there would be buyers, because that is what anybody, including large strategic group like Bertelsmann, likes to buy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you've seen the other side of the spectrum, you know, being a buyer before in the core business. It gives you that insight and realistic viewpoint, you know, of, you know, what really companies need to have in terms of metrics, in terms of growth, to be able to get those kind of exits.
Yeah.
Pankaj, talking about, you know, the portfolio, if you could throw some light, you know, on some of the outlier founding teams, you know, within the Bertelsmann portfolio. I know it's difficult to pick one or two players within that, you know, stellar list that you have, but just from a perspective, right, like when you invested in that founder and how it has turned out over time, which is a team that, you know, has completely blown away your mind by the execution over time?
So I would probably give 2-3 examples. And again, it's very difficult to choose even 2-3 out of yeah, large set of founders who have all amazed us in a very positive way. In fact, I tell everybody that being a venture capitalist, the biggest joy you get is when you go and work with extremely smart and motivated founders who are building amazing companies, and you are part of that and you learn so much from them and you get inspired by them in a significant fashion. For me, it's been an amazing last 10 to 12 years. If I were to name a few, and again, while all founders to me are very, very dear, a few of them that I would like to name would be on certain things that they've done which stood outside of the pack. The first thing I like to look at, entrepreneurs who had the vision to create multiple S-curves. Their business was A, and they came in and not only dominated their own business of A, whatever that product is, but then created B, C, D, E, F, which was not part of their core business. And just having the vision and the strategy and the implementation of creating multiple S-curves is something that is a sheer joy to see. It's not easy to do in normal entrepreneurship. And I think Eruditus and Ashwin Damera and the team and Chet in Eruditus have done something like that. And they've built a global company by finding new S-curves every 6 months and launching those businesses and scaling them up. The second part that I usually see within the entrepreneurial journey is somebody who has the ability to take an extremely complex problem and innovate around it to build a strong business. I look at Licious, I look at Pepperfry on my side, and both of these companies, and you look at why has furniture never been organized in the history of India? Why has meat not done ever in the history of India? Because these are very complex problems. And if somebody is taking such a complex problem and innovating around it to fix it, and nothing can be fixed in one go. It's not about making an app and throwing it and suddenly over 5 years, you've built a $3 billion company. It's solving these problems brick by brick. And that's what India needs. Entrepreneurs who have the passion and the ambition to build companies brick by brick. That motivates me a lot. And lastly, I would say entrepreneurs who ended up building a company which did not exist anywhere in the world, which means it's real innovation, it's not copycat. And if I look at companies like ShipRocket in my portfolio or AgroStar, those are innovations which when these companies started, now, of course, there would be similar companies like that in the US, etc. But these were first time innovations coming out of India. Those stand out for me in a big way. So again, the list kind of continues and I can go on and on. As I said, I'm very proud of all the entrepreneurs, but these are some of the things that kind of got entrepreneurs to stood out, at least for me, more than others. Doesn't mean that others are not doing very amazing work. They're doing great, great work as well. But I would say that is how I would classify this answer.
Very well said, Pankaj. And I think that brings out a lot of humbleness and humility, you know, as to anyone as an investor, just looking at these massive outcomes these founders, bring out over time.
Yeah.
All right. Pankaj, you know, being an investor over such a long period of time, you know, it influences you as a person. From that standpoint, you know, how has being a VC influenced your personality, right, over the years? How has that changed you as a person?
This is such an amazing question. And thank you for asking that question. I think as sectors get transformed by great entrepreneurs, I think our personal lives, being next to these amazing entrepreneurs, have also been transformed. If you were to ask me the kind of key kind of changes that I would have seen in myself today versus 10 years back, I would say I have understood the role of empathy in a very big way. When you work in such a dynamic setup where there are significant highs and lows, then you can't judge an individual or a founder or startups by just looking at their P&L. You live through that journey of highs and lows. And by virtue of all of this, you end up, if you've already built a lot of empathy, but you will build a lot of respect as well as empathy towards everything around you because you've gone through such an humbling experience yourself or seen that humbling experience happen to somebody who is so near and dear to you, either professionally or personally and so on. And I would say over time, if I look at how the venture capital journey has shaped me, it has made me a lot more respectful, a lot more empathetic to the entire journey of startups as well as what founders go through. And now if a founder comes and says, this is not working out, I cannot say that that person did not put his heart and soul to solve it. If a startup does not work, it's okay.
Yeah,
I can understand it. I can empathize with the problem and I'll be very respectful. I'm sure I was like that earlier also, but the level of empathy has just gone to a very different level.
No, I think totally agree to that, Pankaj. And, you know, it talks about the human element or the personal element that comes in, you know, to just this business of investing. It can't be transactional, especially over this long period of time, you know, having that empathy and towards founders, especially, you know, and it's a position of privilege.
You know, you look at even in this downturn, and we are getting into a downturn right now, global uncertainty, etc. And it's very easy to sit in a boardroom and say, why don't you chuck out 10% of your workforce? I think having empathy, not only for your founders, but also for the teams that have spent their significant amount of livelihoods, they're actually at the end of the day, humans working within these startups. And what do you want to do? Is it really necessary? Are there other ways to solve this problem of cash crunch? We first need to think hard about a lot of these things before we come into just saying, why don't you reduce 10% of your workforce? This is, so I think a lot of these learnings have come in over the last 10 years. We've seen not only founders, but companies go through massive ups and downs. Pandemic was not an easy time for anybody. We not only had to make sure startups do well, but we also had to make sure people who were working with us were fit to do their job, as well as they had loved ones around them who were not dying. I mean, that kind of crisis teaches you so much that your entire life gets transformed. And I think all of us as a human race within, you know, everybody has gone through such kind of learnings, and we having kind of seen so many startups and managing so many companies which have tens and tens, if not a hundred of thousands of people working in these portfolio companies on a collective basis, we've seen significant amount of human element, as you correctly pointed out, being played out, you know, every 2-3 years.
No, I think that's absolutely bang on, Pankaj. You know, Pankaj, with that, I'll quickly jump into our final segment. It's been a great conversation, insightful conversation so far. I'm taking away a lot of learnings. I'll jump into the rapid fire now and, you know, shoot some questions and hope to get your honest, immediate thoughts on the same.
Sure. No, happy to kind of answer.
All right. First question, one thing that you'd like to change to improve the state of the Indian startup ecosystem today?
So the startup ecosystem is generally evolving in a very positive way. The only thing I would kind of make it, I would try to make it more collaborative. It is one of the most collaborative industries. Even VC funds work with each other in one deal and they are competing in the other. So from that perspective, it's a great place. I would love to make it more collaborative.
Pankaj, if you had to give a TED talk, what topic would you choose and why?
I think I would talk about the founder's journey from the lens of a VC and what are the positives and negatives I've seen, in case there's any way I can make even one day better for any founder so that he or she can sleep well at night. I think it would be a good TED talk and would love to do that.
The most unusual, memorable pitch meeting that you had with a founder?
Yeah, no, that has to be, I would say, Ashwin, the mayor of Eruditus. We spent a lot of time together when I evaluated the company when he was doing a Series A. Series A was not our DNA. I was not comfortable taking the risk, so I said no to it. The next time when he came again to pitch or just meet us, I thought I would meet him for 20 minutes because I really liked him as a founder. But in that meeting, I ended up sitting down for 5 hours because over the last 6 to 8 months, the time period that he had spent between my first interaction and the second meeting that I had, he had built so much amazing stuff in his company that I was blown away. And my key question to him was, what did you do and how did you even do it? And the time when I came out of that meeting, I knew that I had to invest. And thankfully, he honored us by taking our money and we ended up becoming partners and rest is history and the company has done extremely well. That was an amazing meeting and I can't forget that.
You know, Pankaj, it's been a great conversation. Like I said, any final thoughts for current and aspiring founders, you know, that are listening to you through the podcast?
No, absolutely. I would say that this is a great time to be a founder. The world on one hand has massive amount of problems that need to get solved. We are living in a world which is highly uncertain. It has massive political and geographical instabilities there. We have just come out of COVID. And at the same time, we have technology which can help us solve a bunch of these problems. If you as founders have amazing, innovative solutions to some of these problems, there is significant amount of ecosystem built where capital can be available by virtue of starting with seed funds and early funds and then mid funds like us. Please use that opportunity to take that plunge. There cannot be a better time to be an entrepreneur. I would say if you feel that you have it in you to be a founder or an entrepreneur, do it now. We are all looking forward to meeting you and backing you to build these amazing companies.
Awesome. Awesome. I think, Pankaj, that's a perfect note, you know, to end our conversation on. It's been amazing having you on the podcast. Thank you for, you know, being on the show, taking out the time. And there's so many more topics, you know, I would really like to dive deeper into, but hopefully we'll have you back on the show again to, you know, talk about some of those topics.
No, thank you very much, Digvijay, for having us on the podcast, going through our story, our excitement and ambitions of what we are aiming to build, the journey that we have spent over the last 12 years building this business, and of course, all the learnings and that we've had during this journey. It was amazing being part of the show. The interaction was just amazing, very insightful, and I do hope the audience loves listening to the podcast and look forward to being back on the show whenever there's an opportunity to do so.
Awesome, Pankaj. It was a pleasure for sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the VC Bruna podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please let our guests know about it, share your thoughts on social media, and let them know what were your key takeaways. We would truly appreciate if you could subscribe to our podcast on the podcast platform of your choice and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This will help others discover the podcast. To get insights and to learn more about startups and venture capital, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We will love to hear from you there. You can find all episodes together on our website, thevcpreneur.com. We will be back again next week with another VCpreneur that is making a dent in the venture universe. Until then, take care and keep shining.